Have you ever like stood in front of a monitor just staring at an image you literally just imported from your camera and felt that unmistakable rush? You know, you've tweaked the contrast, maybe dodged the shadows a bit, and you just know in your bones that it's a cracking image.
Oh, absolutely. You're riding high on that creative adrenaline.
Right. So you package it up, you submit it to your local club or some major contest, and you're mentally preparing for the accolades, right? And then the results drop. It doesn't place, it doesn't win. The judge barely gives it a passing glance before just moving to the next frame.
And you're just left there, totally bewildered.
Exactly. You're staring at the screen, wondering what invisible standard you just completely failed to meet.
Yeah, it is a brutal, but honestly nearly universal rite of passage for anyone who dares to put their creative work out there. There's this vast, often really painful chasm between how we perceive our own photographs and how an impartial audience processes them.
It's like two different languages.
It really is.
Yeah.
And bridging that gap, you know, it isn't just about adjusting a slider in Lightroom. It requires completely rewiring how you actually look at your own art.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because today's deep dive is built around some incredibly grounded source material. We're looking at a fantastic analysis of competition strategy called The Competitive Edge: Mastering Photography Critique and Submission.
Yeah, it's a really pragmatic look at the whole process.
It is. And our mission today is to decode the specific mechanics that separate a genuinely winning shot from an entry that, well, just makes up the numbers. We are looking at the concrete psychological and technical shifts you need to elevate your portfolio, especially if you're stuck on a plateau.
And what really anchors this entire discussion is a recent breakthrough at the 2026 Yorkshire Photographic Union Annual Competition.
Right, the author of our source text had a major pivot there.
Exactly. We are looking at the trajectory of someone who spent years, literally years, entering submissions and getting absolutely nowhere. Just zilch, nothing.
Which is so frustrating.
Soul-crushing, really? But then suddenly, a fundamental shift in methodology results in two awarded certificates out of 10 entries at this highly competitive level. And that kind of pivot, it isn't luck. It's the result of rigorously auditing your own failures.
And before we even touch on composition or post-processing or any of that technical stuff, we really have to confront the psychological barrier that ruins more portfolios than bad lighting ever could. I mean, it's the emotional baggage we attach to the image, isn't it?
Oh, 100%. When you look at your own photograph, you aren't actually looking at a two-dimensional grid of pixels. You are reliving a memory.
Yes.
That cognitive bias is, frankly, the single highest hurdle in self-critique. When you review your catalog, your brain instantly loads the metadata of your actual experience.
Like how cold it was, or the hike to get there.
Like you feel the freezing wind from that 4 a.m. hike. You remember the anxiety of the changing tide or that profound interaction you had with the subject right before you pressed the shutter. You are unconsciously grading the effort, you know?
The discomfort and the drama of it all.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But the judge possesses absolutely none of that context. They're operating in a vacuum, evaluating nothing but the visual evidence contained strictly within those four borders.
You know, it really makes me think of cooking an elaborate dinner for someone. You might be in the kitchen for 6 hours, burning your forearm on the stove, spending a small fortune on imported spices, and just totally stressing over the timing.
Oh, I've been there.
Right. And when you finally sit down and taste it, you are consuming the entire narrative of your exhaustion, but your guest. They just know if the chicken is dry. They are only interacting with the reality on the plate.
That is the perfect distinction. The judge is your dinner guest. They're only tasting the final product. Moving a photograph from a, you know, a competent record shot into an evocative piece of art requires you to taste your own food like a stranger.
Which is so hard to do.
It is. You have to actively sever that emotional umbilical cord between the experience of the shoot and the reality of the file.
Which, yeah, sounds great in theory, but overcoming human nature is notoriously difficult. Our first instinct is always to defend our effort.
Always. Ego's a powerful thing.
And the source material points out that finding objective critique is the only way to break that bias, but it highlights a really counterintuitive approach. The author was housebound for a period and had to rely almost entirely on online critique groups instead of the traditional physical camera club.
Right, and we tend to assume that face-to-face feedback is the absolute gold standard for artistic growth. But if you consider the psychological mechanics of an in-person critique, it's actually really fraught.
Because it feels so personal.
Exactly. When someone is standing 3 feet away from you, physically pointing out a wonky horizon or blown-out highlight, The brain's threat detection system, the amygdala, it often just kicks right in.
Yeah.
Our ego flares up to defend our choices.
Oh, totally. We start making excuses out loud. We start explaining, like, why we couldn't get a better angle or why the light was bad.
Right. You're defending the process instead of looking at the result. But a digital screen introduces this necessary friction. Receiving critique in a text thread or a forum, it strips away that immediate social pressure.
You can just read it and stew for a minute.
Yeah, it removes the need to defend yourself in real time. It allows you to absorb the criticism intellectually rather than emotionally. A sharp critique isn't a personal attack, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's a diagnostic tool revealing the blind spots your ego just wouldn't let you see.
So once we actually manage to silence that defensive instinct, we need a diagnostic framework to work with. And the material outlines this self-critique hit list, and it starts right off with visual hierarchy.
Which is crucial.
It forces you to ask, like, when a stranger looks at this, do they know where to anchor their gaze instantly? Or are they left rummaging about in the frame like they've lost their car keys?
I love that phrasing because the visual cortex is fundamentally lazy. It really is. It wants a clear path to follow.
It doesn't want to work for it.
No, not at all. If an image is cluttered with competing elements of contrast or sharpness, the viewer experiences cognitive overload. They don't linger to figure out the puzzle. They simply move on. A strong center of interest is the anchor that basically buys you the viewer's attention.
Now, regarding that center of interest, I actually need to push back on one of the strictest edicts in the source text.
Oh, let's hear it.
The author argues that for portraits, wildlife, or macro work, if the eyes aren't tack sharp, the image is fundamentally broken. He calls it an error that can't be unseen. But, I mean, art isn't an engineering exam, right? What about intentional motion blur to convey panic, or a shallow depth of field that renders a subject dreamlike and abstract? Insisting on razor-sharp corneas in every shot feels like a deeply rigid way to evaluate art.
Well, it is a rigid standard, yes, but it's rooted in evolutionary biology, not just, you know, photographic pedantry.
Okay, how so?
Humans are highly social predators. We are biologically hardwired to seek out eyes to determine intent or threat or connection. When a judge looks at a living subject, their own visual system automatically darts to the eyes.
I guess that makes sense. It's an instinct.
Right. And if the eyes are soft, the brain registers it as a visual failure before conscious thought even takes over. Now, while profound artistic exceptions definitely exist, in the context of a competition, a soft eye is almost universally interpreted as missed autofocus, rather than a bold narrative choice.
It just looks like a mistake.
Yeah, it creates this jarring disconnect that pulls the viewer entirely out of the emotional experience.
So the baseline expectation is technical mastery. If you're going to break a biological viewing habit, you have to break it so aggressively and intentionally that the judge instantly recognizes your deliberate control of the medium.
Precisely. You have to prove you know the rules before you break them. And that hyperfocus on the subject brings us to the next massive blind spot, which is tunnel vision.
Oh, this happens all the time.
Right. When you are looking through the viewfinder, tracking a moving subject and waiting for that perfect expression, you are completely ignoring the periphery. And this is why the hit list heavily emphasizes border patrol.
Checking the edges for chaos. It is genuinely wild how you can spend an hour meticulously editing the contrast on a bird's feathers and completely fail to notice the glaring white plastic bag creeping into the bottom left corner.
Or a half-severed hand protruding into the side of a street portrait.
Exactly. How do we miss that?
Well, our brains filter out irrelevant information in the field to help us focus on our primary goal. But a photograph freezes everything. The border of an image acts as a container for the viewer's eye.
So if there's a distraction on the edge,
it acts like a visual leak. If there is a bright blob of light or a distracting shape intersecting the edge of the frame, the viewer's attention just bleeds right out of the picture.
And trying to fix those leaks often leads to the next major pitfall, which is the dreaded next morning regret of post-processing. We have all been there.
Oh, the slider abuse.
You're in a dark room. You're pushing the shadows, dragging the clarity slider way up, dialing up the vibrance. It feels incredibly dynamic and punchy in the moment. Then you wake up, open Lightroom with your morning coffee, and recoil because your landscape looks like a radioactive wasteland.
What's fascinating here is the physiology behind that mistake. It is actually visual adaptation.
Like your eyes get used to it.
Exactly. When you stare at a glowing monitor for an extended period, the photoreceptors in your eyes literally become fatigued. Your brain adapts to the new baseline of color and contrast. To get the same dopamine hit of punchiness, you have to keep pushing the sliders further and further.
Wow, so you're essentially building up a tolerance to your own edit.
You are. You're constantly chasing that initial impact, and you end up deep ending everything way too far.
That makes me think of walking through the perfume department at a mall. You know how they keep little jars of coffee beans on the counter? Because after smelling three heavy fragrances, your olfactory receptors are completely blown out. You can't distinguish anything anymore. You need a sensory reset.
The visual cortex must do the exact same
It
thing.
has to, right?
It does, which is why stepping away is non-negotiable. The author's 24-hour rule is brilliant. It allows the visual cortex to reset to the real world.
Give yourself a break, have a brew, come back tomorrow.
Yes, because when you open the file the next day, you instantly recognize the overly crunchy textures, the artificial halos from noise reduction, and that unnatural saturation that your fatigued eyes totally normalized the night before.
So let's assume we survive the artistic audit. The composition is tight, the visual hierarchy is clear, the borders are locked down, the edit is tasteful. This brings us to a transition that crushes a lot of photographers.
The admin.
Yes, we move from the poetry of art to the brutal bureaucracy of competition administration. A masterpiece will be unceremoniously disqualified if it fails the pre-flight checks.
Because judges and competition organizers are processing massive volumes of data, hundreds, thousands of images. They simply do not have the bandwidth to fix your administrative errors.
And reading the rules sounds elementary. But the sheer volume of high-quality work rejected just for naming conventions or color space mismatches is staggering.
Ooh, it happens constantly.
And part of that friction is category fit. The source material warns against shoehorning an image into a category just to fill an entry quota.
Yeah, that's a classic mistake. If a category calls for monochrome and your image is just a highly desaturated color file that still retains a faint, blue tint in the shadows, a judge will toss it instantly.
Because it signals a lack of respect for the parameters of the exhibition.
Precisely.
Huh.
And the same logic applies to padding your entry. Photographers often feel compelled to submit their maximum allowed number of images. They'll toss in a few weaker, they'll do shots just to make up the numbers.
But that backfires, doesn't it?
Completely.
That's a huge mindset shift for beginners. Now, diving into the technical prep, I have to admit, I always thought zooming in to 100% on a monitor to scour for sensor dust was just a bad habit of gear reviewers and pixel peepers.
A lot of people think that.
If a judge is evaluating the emotional impact of a composition from 10 feet away, why aren't we agonizing over a microscopic cloning artifact?
Because of what happens when that file leaves the controlled, safe environment of your personal monitor.
Okay, what do you mean?
In a club setting, your image is often being pumped through a high-lumen digital projector onto a massive screen, or it's being run through a commercial printer for, like, an A3 exhibition piece. Those display mediums utilize aggressive interpolation algorithms that will take a tiny, almost invisible sharpening halo and magnify it into a glowing, jagged outline.
Oh, wow. So the medium actually exaggerates the flaws. What looks like a tiny smudge of sensor dust on a 15-inch laptop suddenly becomes a fist-sized dark spot hovering in the sky on a projection screen.
Exactly. You are preemptively auditing the file for structural weaknesses before the stress of the display medium tears it apart. Furthermore, you have to ensure the structural integrity of your archives.
Right, keeping the original files safe.
Yes. The rules surrounding digital manipulation are becoming increasingly militant, and honestly, for good reason. If you enter a documentary or nature category, the fundamental contract with the viewer is that the event actually happened as depicted.
Which means absolutely no dropping in a dramatic storm sky you bought in a preset pack or cloning out a distracting telephone pole.
Zero tolerance for that. And the enforcement mechanism for this is ruthless. If you make it to the finals of a major exhibition, they don't just take your word for it. They demand the original raw file straight from the camera's memory card.
Because the raw file is the ultimate proof.
It contains the unalterable metadata footprint of the exact moment of capture. It is the digital negative. If your archiving system is a chaotic mess, the digital equivalent of a sock drawer, and you cannot produce that original file to prove the authenticity of your edit, you forfeit the placement.
Ouch!
Yeah, losing a medal because your composition was weak is a learning experience.
Yeah.
Losing a medal because you couldn't find your own file in your digital storage is an unmitigated disaster.
So the administrative gauntlet is cleared, the technical baseline is flawless. But as we know, flawless execution does not guarantee a win, it just gets you a seat at the table. To actually stand out, you really have to account for the psychological state of the person evaluating the work.
Which is usually fatigue. Judges are staring at hundreds, sometimes thousands of images over a weekend.
Right. So we have to consider the phenomenon of visual habituation. When a judge sees the first beautifully executed sunset over a famous landmark, they might score it well. But by the time they see the 40th identical sunset from the exact same tripod holes,
their brain literally stops releasing the dopamine associated with novelty. They become completely numb to the subject matter, regardless of how sharp the focus is or how well the borders are patrolled.
The source material specifically calls this out as another robin on a branch. It is the quintessential trap of technically perfect but utterly forgettable photography.
Yeah, to pierce through that habituation, you need a fresh perspective. You need an unusual focal length, a bizarre juxtaposition, or light that fundamentally alters the geometry of the scene.
Let's talk about light, actually, because that's so key.
Light is the actual medium we are molding. We often think of light merely as the utility that exposes the sensor so we can see the thing. But light dictates the emotional frequency of the image.
So true.
Flat midday light will render a majestic mountain range incredibly boring, while the extreme directional grazing light of a stormy dusk can make an old, rusted tractor look like a profound monument. The question isn't just, is there enough light?
Mm-hmm.
But rather, how is this light sculpting the depth and tension of this specific subject?
And if we carry that idea of physical properties into the final presentation, we have to talk about the physical print. While so much of modern competition is digital projection, introducing a physical piece of paper into the real world completely changes the calculus.
It's a whole different ballgame.
The image ceases to be backlit data and becomes a tactile object.
Right. A print relies on ambient light reflecting off its surface to reach the judge's eye. This makes the texture of the paper, the surface tension, a critical part of the artistic delivery.
So the paper choice isn't just an afterthought.
Not at all. A high-contrast architectural shot printed on a deep, glossy metallic paper carries an entirely different aggressive energy than a soft, foggy landscape printed on a heavy, textured cotton rag.
And the mounting, the weight of the board, the precision of the it all telegraphs intent. A poorly mounted print that warps under the gallery lights tells the judge that you don't respect your own work enough to finish it properly.
Exactly. It breaks the illusion of mastery. Every single choice, from the focal length in the field to the texture of the map board, must feel deliberately considered.
So what does this all mean? We've traced the journey from the initial sting of rejection, through the cognitive blind spots of our own egos, past the bureaucratic landmines of file management, all the way to the physical reality of a finished print.
It's a long journey.
It really is. For someone staring down their next competition submission, the overriding theme here seems to be a brutal but necessary patience.
Yeah, the architecture of a winning portfolio isn't built overnight. The author who achieved that breakthrough at the Yorkshire Photographic Union didn't stumble into a secret preset.
They did the work.
They spent years analyzing their losses, stripping away their emotional biases, and recalibrating their standards. But the most vital takeaway from this entire process isn't about accumulating certificates or chasing the validation of a high score.
The competition is just a mechanism, isn't it?
Exactly. The real value is the profound change in how you process the world visually. Subjecting yourself to rigorous, objective critique burns away your bad habits.
It makes you a better observer.
It forces you to stop relying on the luck of a beautiful sunset and start communicating with intentional clarity. You become infinitely more selective. You learn how to make an image that demands the viewer halt their scrolling, stop their walking, and actually engage with the narrative you've constructed.
It is the difference between simply recording a moment and actively authoring one, which brings us back to that massive gap between what we feel and what the audience sees. So, as you head out with your camera this weekend, I want you to consider a final thought.
Leave them with something to chew on.
Exactly. If a stranger were to look at your absolute favorite photograph, completely stripped of your memories, the freezing wind, the exhaustion, and the thrill of the moment, if they only had the visual evidence you trapped inside those four borders, what story would they actually tell you about your own image?